Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be here this morning. We have a great crowd. Glad to see everybody that is out. I don't think I was originally on the schedule for today, but because of some upcoming vacations, we had to switch some stuff around, so you get to listen to me this morning. For a little while, we're going to talk about a subject that I've entitled, Take a Seat. It's kind of a neat little story. I have some papers. I think I got everybody. If I missed you, I'll get in a second. It's kind of a rendition. I'll show you the big picture of it. It's of the tabernacle. It's been about 5 years ago, we did a pretty in-depth study on the tabernacle. I didn't realize it had been that long ago. The tabernacle is one of the neatest stories, I guess, we can find. How much information is included in the tabernacle, because it is a shadow. It was a pattern for what was to come. In Exodus 25:8, it says, "And let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them. According to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it." And so the old tabernacle, and then was later kind of recreated in the temple, but God had designed how he wanted worship under the old covenant. And it was very structured. And so when it starts talking about a pattern, you better believe there was a pattern. It had to be exactly the way that it was drawn up. It had to have certain dimensions. It had to be made of certain different colors. It had to have certain types of furniture. It was very, very specific how the old tabernacle was to be made. And then we start figuring out this tabernacle was kind of a foreshadowing of what was to come as far as the church and even with heaven. It's a wonderful, outstanding study. This morning, we're not going to talk about all the typology of the tabernacle. I did find an old lesson. I found it was Linwood Smith. I don't know how long ago that lesson was given about the tabernacle. It's one of the most interesting studies that you could probably find. But we're going to talk a little bit about the pattern and how the pattern was provided for worship in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant. And I believe it also gives us a glimpse of the pattern for the church in the New Testament. So what we're going to do for this morning for a little while, it's not a real long lesson, but we're going to take a walk through the tabernacle. So this is kind of a model that's been built somewhere to kind of give you an idea, a visual of what the tabernacle was like. So now if you take that little piece of paper that I got you, that was a big old sheet, like the old-timey preachers used to do. Jerry Dickinson has one. I'll show you a picture of it in a second. That's actually Clint de France, who's probably younger than me, but he's an old soul. So he kind of went back to the old style. And when Clint de France gave this lesson, he put it on one of the big old sheets and had it hanging across the back. I think he gave it, I heard him in Grapevine, I think is where I want to say. But anyway, if you take that picture and kind of turn it just right, you'll see how it all sets up. And you'll see, here's the brazen altar, here's the laver, and then here's the tabernacle itself proper. So if you get it turned just right, you can see how this is all going to line up. So we're going to use that as kind of just as a visual description of the tabernacle. And really we're only going to talk about one specific part of the typology, but it really makes a lot of difference as we start studying in the New Testament. Before we go further, though, let's take opportunity now to go to God and work for him. Well, that's from Jerry Dickinson. If you remember Jerry, the evangelist, he likes to come in and hang these sheets down, stretch out across the front of the building. That's one that he had. And his lesson was called According to the Pattern, and he kind of had this all drawn up. So I'm going to use some of his picture because I like it. And then I said the second one, this is from Clint France. So that's where I took that and just kind of shrunk it down. I realize it's really, really small, but I'll blow it up at different parts of the lesson. Now, the only problem I have with Clint France, the way he drew it up, I think I have a genetic disorder or something when it comes to directions. I have no idea which way is north, south, east, or west. You don't ask me directions like that. I have no idea. I can get so turned around. The only way I can do it is I have to visualize a map, and north has to be at the top. And west is to the left. And that's about the only way I can do it. And the way Brother Clint has it drawn up, he's got north up at the top. And then, but the writing is going sideways. So if you flip it up like it's supposed to, he's got west up at the top. And I think I have a genetic malfunction or something, because my mind can't really wrap around it for whatever reason. I got to have north up at the top. And you might be thinking, what difference does it make? Well, it makes a whole bunch of difference when you follow the pattern, because the tabernacle had to open in a certain direction. And the furniture had to be set in certain directions. The apartment had to be on the north wall and the south wall. It always had to open from the east. I don't know why. I mean, I can't tell you the exact reason, but I'm telling you, and as you begin to kind of go through this study, you're going to see there is so much crossover and symbolism that is used. And verses will probably start popping into your mind. That probably has reference to this, and you're right, it does. It's an unbelievable story. It's one of the most powerful lessons probably that we can teach. So we're going to use Clint's a little bit as we kind of take our walk through the tabernacle. Now, it was very set up, and we kind of saw that model at the beginning. It was almost kind of fenced in, so to speak. And so we had what was called the outer court, and then this was actually the tabernacle proper. And this is kind of what looked like that little circus tent in that model. This was the tabernacle. This was called the outer court, the land that surrounded it, but that was enclosed by the fence. But you could consider it all being part of the tabernacle proper. Once you got outside the fence, then you were no longer in the tabernacle. So if you were a Gentile, if you were not of the tribes of the sons of Israel, you had to stay outside. Anybody could go, or any of the children of Israel could come inside into the outer court. But it's going to get real specific as to who can go where and when in a hurry. So first, let's start with the outer court. So what I've done, I just kind of took this picture and I cropped it. And so we'll just kind of slowly make our way through this picture. This is called the outer court. And I had to turn it so I could get it where my words were facing the right way. So in the outer court, the Jews, or the children, nation of Israel, they would enter in, they would come into the outer court, and there they would deliver up their animal that was going to be sacrificed. So they would take it to one of the priests, and the priest would accept it there in the outer court. Inside the outer court was known as the brazen altar. And so the brazen altar is where the priest would slay the animal. And then they would take the blood, and it was very specific what had to happen with the blood and how the blood was to be handled. But there was four little horns. And then they would have to place blood upon the horns on the corner of that altar. And then they would sprinkle it on the altar. They would sprinkle it on the priest. And so that was known as the brazen altar. Well, as you can imagine, when you're sitting there messing with animals and blood, you're going to get filthy. And the priests were, I can't even imagine it. I can't imagine what it would be like to work at Producers. I can't imagine having to go out and kill those animals. And just what it was like. And so as they made their way into the tabernacle proper, we had to stop. And this was called the labor, or the laver. I've heard it pronounced both ways. I would say the labor. And so that was a spot that would hold water where they could wash up and they could clean themselves to get all of this blood and dirt and gunk before they entered into the tabernacle. The washing was used as part of consecration. That was to make themselves holy before they could enter into the tabernacle proper. And also the priests were commanded to have daily washing of hands and feet. And so they would have to clean themselves in the labor before they entered into the tabernacle proper. Now remember, any of the nation of Israel could enter into the outer court. But now once we get up here, and Clint has it drawn as dotted lines. When you cross that line, when you enter into the tabernacle, you had to be of the tribe of Levi. Only the Levites can enter into the tabernacle. So this first little entrance that we would come into, where they would enter into the tabernacle, is known as the holy place. And so the priest would then enter into the holy place, and you would notice there's kind of some special furniture here, okay? Even the way they entered was specific. There was this blue and red and purple woven linen door. So they just couldn't put up any kind of door they wanted to. It had to be a certain type of door. It had to be certain dimensions. Everything was set according to this pattern. Very, very, very specific. So the priest would come in, and there's three things of furniture here. There is this candlestick or this lampstand. The menorah is what it's known as today. It's got that seven parts up at the top where the seven flames would come out. Now, it's really not a candlestick. It's more of a lamp. And I suppose the difference would be a candle we think of has wax, and a lamp has oil. It was actually made of gold. In fact, everything in the most or in the holy place, in this part of the tabernacle, everything was covered in gold. So this was pretty pricey, expensive things right here. But they had the candlestick. We had what was called the altar of incense. And we had the table of showbread. So we'll kind of talk about each one of those very quickly. Now the furniture had to have a certain location. So I put both pictures up here. There's Clint's on the left. And this is Jerry Dickinson's on the right. Just to kind of give you a different idea of what they think it might look like. They had what was called the table of showbread. Now the table of showbread had to be on the north wall. Specified. The candle or the lampstand had to be on the south wall, and then the altar of incense had to face on the west wall. It was very specific where everything had to be, every piece of furniture had a purpose and it had a reason. And if you start really, really thinking about it, you're also going to see that every piece of furniture in the holy place also had a foreshadowing of something in the future. Now, we're not going to get that far into it today, but that's a real neat study in and of itself. So now the priests would come in, they would enter into the holy place. I guess first they'd stop off at the table of the showbread. And the table of showbread had to be made from a certain type of wood, just like thinking about Noah's Ark, had to be made from a certain type of wood, had to be made of acacia wood, and it was overlaid with pure gold. Now on it there were 12 loaves of bread, one for each of the tribes of Israel. Now, Jerry Dickens kind of has it drawn out like this. He's got like 12 loaves. It's kind of two rolls of six. Or maybe it could be six rolls of two. I don't know. Clint, he has it drawn up like this. This is how I've seen most pictures look like. It has them stacked up like donuts on a stick. You know, six on this stack and then six on this stack. I don't know what it looked like. I can't tell you that. But what I do know is that there were 12 loaves of unleavened bread that were eaten every Sabbath day. And then the priests were allowed to eat them, and then the bread was replaced. So that was known as the table of showbread. Well, then we had the lampstand. Okay, so here we go. The menorah is what we're going to hear it called today. And that's kind of one of the symbols of Judaism today, the menorah. It was about 3 foot tall, made of one piece of pure gold. It had to be hammered out a certain way. You couldn't do it with PVC pipe. You couldn't fake it. It had to be made of pure gold. Now, I kind of found this from a source. I don't know if it's right or not. It sounds pretty expensive to me, but that's what they say. That it probably weighed approximately 114 pounds, and it'd be worth over $3 million in today's money. Because it was pure, solid gold. One piece that had been hammered out. That's pretty impressive. And again, it was a lamp rather than a candle. Because it didn't have wax that burned. It had oil that was pumped through it that would be allowed to keep it burning. So that's the lampstand. Then we have the altar of incense. Now the altar of incense, the reason it had to be on the west wall is because it was the closest thing you could get to before you got to the most holy place. So it's right up there against the veil. This is called the altar of incense. So here's Clint's picture of it here. Again, it's also made of pure gold. God gave even the exact recipe for the incense. It was a certain mixture, a certain recipe that was only to be used in the tabernacle. However much of each spice had to be put in, it was calculated, it was precise, it was exact. Now this altar was perfectly square in design, and it had horns on it, kind of like the brazen altar had. And so these three things were found inside what was called the holy place. So we got the outer court. Okay, any of the nation of Israel could go to the outer court. Then you get to the holy place. Only the Levites can go into the holy place. Well, now we're going to enter the most holy place. And so that is the picture way here, as far to the west as you can get. This last little room, this last little enclosure is known as the most holy place. Sometimes you might hear it called the holiest of holy, but normally it's referred to as the most holy place. Now, for the most holy place, there was only one person that could enter the most holy place. Once a year, the high priest was allowed to enter the holy of holies, or the most holy place. And the high priest would have to enter through a very heavy veil. Again, specific how the veil was to be made and how it was to be woven and which colors were to be used. But this heavy veil separated the holy place from the most holy place. So the closest you could get to the most holy place without going in it was to be there at the altar of incense. We can get into some symbolic meaning of that too if we wanted to. It's pretty interesting. So, once a year, the high priest was allowed to make his entrance into the most holy place. And that was what was known as the Day of Atonement. There were 7 feasts that the Lord had established. And the Day of Atonement was one of them that the nation of Israel was supposed to follow. And so the Day of Atonement was one of the most... It is considered the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. They call it today as Yom Kippur. And so that holiday is still celebrated today by the Jews. Of course, it doesn't have the significance of the high priest going into the most holy place in the tabernacle. But this idea of, it's actually the first day of the year. And so it's, I believe that's right, if I say that correctly. But this idea of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is a very, very important day in the religion of the Old Covenant. The high priest would pass through the veil, and he would enter into this last section of the most holy place. In the most holy place, there was only one piece of furniture, and it was the Ark of the Covenant. The high priest would first have to offer blood for his own sins, and then he would offer blood for the sins of the people. So it was a two-part sacrifice. Because as a high priest, he was still a man. He had to offer forgiveness for himself and then for the nation. You also notice this word here. It says mercy seat. You can read it pretty carefully on Jerry's version. This is the mercy seat up here at the top. The mercy seat was the top. It was the covering. And it had some cherubims that sat there and they kind of looked at each other. And that's where God would communicate with his people. So we got the Ark of the Covenant here. It was one piece of furniture, the Ark of the Covenant, and it was topped by the mercy seat. The mercy seat, is from a Bible dictionary, is the name for the lid or the covering of the Ark of the Covenant. So that concept is very, very important. It's brought up again in the New Testament. But here's what Exodus 25, the original instructions, tell us about the mercy seat. Exodus 25, verse 17, "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. And ye shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work. Ye shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat." Pure gold, the cherubims are a type of angel, 2 angels, one on either side. Verse 21 says, "Ye shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark ye shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat." So that's inside the Ark of the Covenant. That's where the 10 Commandments went. That's where the rod, that Aaron's rod that budded. There was several things that went inside of it. The mercy seat went on top of it. It was a lid, had the cherubims. And it says, that's where I'm going to meet with you. Okay? So God, in a form of light, the Jews called this the Shekinah light, would sit right on top of that when he was talking to him. He would sit right on top of it. So what the priest would do is, the priest would have to come in, they would offer sacrifice for themselves, and they would have to sprinkle blood on the mercy seat. And then they would offer a sacrifice on the behalf of the nation, and again, they'd sprinkle blood on the mercy seat. And that was what was known as the Day of Atonement. And there's our walk through the tabernacle. Here's my picture. Kristen, please don't laugh at me. I don't have the technical computer skills you do. That's as good as I can do. So we start out here in the outer court. So that's the area outside the temple proper, or the tabernacle proper. First thing you come across is number one, the brazen altar. Past the brazen altar, you get to the laver. Once you got to the laver, you would then be allowed to go inside if you were a Levite. So the Levite would come in the holy place. You had the table of showbread. You had the lampstand or the candlestick. And you had the altar of incense. Separating the holy place and the most holy place was the veil. Remember when Jesus died on the cross, that veil in the temple split? Yeah, you're going to start picking up on things that are highly, highly symbolic. They're there for a reason. And then finally, the most holy place, in which you would find the Ark of the Covenant topped with the mercy seat. So I have a quick question for you, and then we're done. Remember, the lesson was titled, Take a Seat. I have a question for you. In the tabernacle, where were the chairs for the priests to sit down and rest? Now, the first thing I'm told every time I've taken a job is you got to find out where the break room is. First thing you do. In my line of work, we call it the teacher's lounge. That's the first thing they tell you. There's your classroom, and that's the teacher's lounge. You got to know where you can kind of pull back, where you can get away from everything and rest and relax. Where can you kick your feet up? In the tabernacle, where were the chairs for the priest to sit down and rest? Okay, because everything is very specific, right? It had to be on certain walls. You had to have this. You had to have this in a certain spot. The answer? None. There were no chairs. Where did the priest sit down and relax? Where was the priest break from? There wasn't one. Because the priest didn't get a break. So I ask you, was this by design? The answer is yes. This was absolutely by design. We've been studying at home the book of Hebrews. And this is basically the concept of Hebrews, is the writer is trying to establish the superiority of Jesus. How Jesus is superior to everything else. And it's full of what in education we call compare and contrast. There's different ideas that are brought forth. And this imagery has one purpose, and that is to show that Jesus is superior to everything. And if you go back through the book of Hebrews, you'll see a discussion about how Jesus is greater than the angels. And then you'll see a discussion about how Jesus is greater than a man. You'll see a discussion about how Jesus is greater than the high priest. There's a discussion about Melchizedek. It kind of seems out of place, but it talks about how Melchizedek was greater than Abraham. And then it's the order of Melchizedek. He's a priest of the order of Melchizedek, and how that's greater than being the order of the priest of Levi. The new covenant's greater than the old covenant. The sacrifice of Jesus is greater than any animal sacrifice. So as you go through about the first 10 books of Hebrews, it's just these comparison and contrasting. And the whole idea is to show that Jesus and his sacrifice is greater than anything that the old covenant could offer, period. And so you notice I put that one in red there. Jesus was greater than the high priest. Greater than Aaron. Greater than any of the sons of Aaron or the grandson. Jesus as the high priest was greater than anything that the old covenant could offer. So go back to Hebrews, the first chapter. The first verse. Because this is probably something as Gentiles. We probably just skimmed right through and never even noticed it. But to someone who really understood the Jewish way of law and the Jewish way of religion, this probably hit them like a ton of bricks. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in times past to the fathers by His prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son, whom He has appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the worlds, who being the brightness of His glory and the express image of His person and upholding all things by the word of His power, when He had by Himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. And if you were a Jew that understood the concept of the priest, and the priest had to stand all day long, and now it says that Jesus sat down at the right hand of the Majesty of God, it would have just... And He says it in the first sentence of Hebrews. And that idea, this subtle little reference about that Jesus was able to sit down, that Jesus sat down at the right hand of God rather than standing, that is the most powerful thing you could ever express, I suppose, to someone who understood the reference. That concept is brought forth several times in the book of Hebrews. It just kind of pops up. Hebrews 8:1. Now this is the main point, he says, the main point of the things we are saying. Remember all these compare and contrast, he's going back and forth. He says, this is the main idea right here. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord erected and not man. He says, we have a high priest that's better than any high priest ever, because our high priest gets to sit down. You see, the other high priest couldn't do that. They didn't have a chair. They had to stand up the entire time, and they had to finish their work. And that's the idea. Jesus, as high priest, finished His work. So here's the little subtle argument that's made. The Levitical high priests are those that are from the lineage of Aaron. The original high priest never could finish their work. Ever. And therefore, they could never sit down on the job because there was always work to be done. There were always sins to atone for. Because even though they had gotten through the Day of Atonement and they had taken care of the previous year's sins, guess what? We had new sins that we had to deal with. The high priest's work was never, ever done. And therefore, he couldn't sit down. Jesus, on the other hand, finished his work. Jesus was able to atone for sins once and for all. He's finished, and now he gets to sit down. And not only does he get to sit down, the imagery is given that he gets to kick his feet up on an ottoman. He says he gets to treat the earth as his footstool. He gets to sit down and kick his feet up because one time, that's all it took, Jesus was able to atone for the sins of mankind. Let's keep going. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 26. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who was holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. See the argument now? They say those other high priests, man, they had to have daily cleansing and daily sacrifices. They had to go into the Day of Atonement. They had to offer sins for themselves. They had to offer sins for the people. We have a high priest that doesn't have to do that because he was able to atone for sins one time. Let me give you one more passage. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 11. This one kind of puts it all together. And every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. So the old priest, they were sacrificed day after day after day. The high priest would go into the Day of Atonement every year. They would offer these sacrifices. And it says they had to stand ministering daily because what they were doing never forgave sins. They were just having it had to be constant. It never could stop. Verse 12, but this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God from that time waiting till his enemies are made his footstool. For by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. And isn't that awesome? That's what the book of Hebrews is really trying to say in a nutshell. The new covenant is so much greater than the old covenant. And we better be so thankful that we are under the law of Christ instead of being under the law of Moses. That we have a high priest that offered himself once. As in the law of Moses, man, that high priest had to go in every single year and continually do the same sacrifices. The common priest had to do sacrifices every single day. And they always had to stand. They never got to take a seat because their work was never, ever finished. So I hope we appreciate the imagery. Maybe as Gentile readers in the book of Hebrews, we don't always appreciate that. But when the Jews, they were reading that, and those scribes and the Pharisees, they heard that, they knew exactly what was being said. That Jesus was so much more powerful than the high priest. Let me conclude. In the tabernacle worship, the high priest entered the most holy place once every year to atone for sins. First he had to do his sins, and then it was the sins of the people. This was known as the Day of Atonement. His job was never complete, so he had to stand continually. He never got to take a break. He never got to relax. And there are no chairs in the tabernacle. Jesus only had to atone once. He was finished. He took care of everything. His blood covered all sins. He atoned for him. He didn't have to atone for himself. He just had to make one sacrifice to atone for the sins of the world. And he's done. And now Jesus is able to sit at the right hand of God. Concludes the remarks I've had this morning. We never like to close, though, without having a song of invitation. If we can help you in any way, we'll stand ready to assist you at this time.